duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Holy hell, Higher Side Chatters, how the heck are you? What a wonderful day it is. Smoking a little smoke, drinking a little drink here in sunny San Diego. I'm Greg Carlwood, and today we got a great show with Ken Girard talking all things flying humanoids, winged creature sightings, the Tengu, the Teratorns, even Leonardo da Vinci. But before we dive in, a lot of you have asked, what is up with Conspiracy HQ? Why did it suddenly close? And honestly, I'm as confused as a lot of you people. We spent months planning and having meetings and working everything out where we were going to have a great team all working together. And on the day of launch, the partner who owned the domain and did a lot of the web work decided to change the business model, which really sucked. And some people in the group were really depending on this plan to work. And after changing the rules in the middle of the game, 2 days later, he shut down the whole website, put it under someone else's control, locked us out, deleted his Facebook account, and has disappeared, really. I don't get it. I've heard 3 conflicting stories as to why. Honestly, I wish him the best. No ill will. And I do wish it would have been handled differently, but no hard feelings. I just have to move forward for myself, which brings me to some of the changes here at THC. You know, I took this leap from the corporate world to pursue the one passion I think I'm pretty good at, and it's been great, and support has been amazing, and these money bombs are hitting record numbers and bringing me in $800 a month or so, and I'm giving out $800 a month or so, and that's great, but it really isn't enough to live on, and savings are going fast, and I'm almost 30. I'm living on a wing and a prayer, and my girlfriend and I, we want to move on with the next stages of life. I don't have any insurance. I don't know how much I'm going to have next month. All these things are kind of difficult and super stressful, and as much as I don't want to go this route, I hope I've done enough so far to show the people that I'm a guy of integrity. But we are going to keep the money bomb going. It's been amazing. Other shows are duplicating it. Journalists are writing articles about the creativity of the model, and I would not get rid of that. And THC has also traditionally been an hour-long show, except for a few exceptions, and it's been free. Again, nothing is going to change there. We are still doing everything the same, but starting August 1st, I'm going to be recording 2-hour interviews with every guest, and the second hour will be considered the plus show and will be available for a $5 monthly subscription. I know I am not super psyched either, but if I want to keep doing this, this is how it's got to happen. I've talked to a lot of other podcasters in the field. We are all figuring this out as we go. It is a new sector of the economy, and this just seems to be the way it works, and it's how it's got to happen. And I hope the people value the show enough for it to be worth one latte a month or $1 an episode. I think it's the cheapest subscription in the field. I mean, Red Ice is $8 US, Mysterious Universe is $9, Coast to Coast is a national chock full of commercial breaks radio show, and it's still $7 a month for the archives. I think that's a lot to ask, and I think this is the best way to move forward for myself because I just can't be supported by ads. We talk about way too many explosive topics, and it just wouldn't work. I can't have sponsors suddenly pull out because we talked about the Boston bombing or the Holocaust or whatever it may be when I'm depending on that money to pay rent. I've already been kicked off of several networks who at first, we're super excited to have us on board. We're really happy about the numbers. We're really excited to have a fresh, new, young show in the conspiracy market. And then whether it be an F-bomb or a controversial topic, we've been dropped. Art Bell's Dark Matter is the latest example. But that's fine. To do the show right, we're not going to be able to depend on third parties. It's going to have to be us, guys. I think some people are going to be really psyched about getting longer interviews, so it's not all bad. I think it's going to be awesome. I'm working out some of the stuff with people who have donated large amounts to the Money Bomb, and those who have already been putting in monthly. I'm going to talk to you all very soon, I'm sure. So keep your eyes open for a THC Plus addition to the menu bar at thehighersidechats.com, and subscriptions will be open soon. We're keeping the Money Bomb going again for listeners because it's just done too much good, and I'm working on making many different payment options and combinations, so you can have as many options as you want, and access to the Plus show is going to be easy and enjoyable, and will probably get better as we go. So there it is. I have ripped the Band-Aid off. I hope you'll all join me on the Plus side, and I'm going to need a new theme song also. So if you can create a high-quality recording and sing and probably play piano, email me, because I've got some ideas. And with that said, let's get weird with Flying Humanoids and Ken Gearhard. I love you, folks. Enjoy the show. All right, Higher Side Chatters, you should know by now that every so often I like breaking up the analysis of secrets, crimes, and rituals of the elite with a good old-fashioned cryptozoology show. And while we've taken an in-depth look at mysterious creatures of the sea, Sasquatch-like ape men, swamp-dwelling lizard men, and the freaky wolfmen sightings of the American Midwest, there's really only one category of cryptid left that could really raise the bar of high weirdness, and that's the bird men, the winged beasts, and the far-reaching category of flying humanoids, which have a rich history of sightings and span centuries and beyond. And my guest today is Ken Gearhard, the current king of the hill when it comes to strange wings that go flap in the night, thanks to his recent book, Encounters with Flying Humanoids, Mothman, Man-Birds, Gargoyles, and Other Winged Beasts. Ken is a world-famous cryptozoologist investigating creatures from all over this wacky planet and has been featured on shows like Monster Quest, Legend Hunters, and Coast to Coast AM, and I couldn't be happier to have him here on THC. Ken, my man, how the hell are you?
Hey, Greg. It's great to be on your show.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks. It is a real pleasure. I'm a guy who's pretty much over Bigfoot, and the only cryptids that still intrigue me are the weird sightings of things with wings, so I really dug this book, and there's so many sightings in it. I mean, were you surprised at all with just how much material you ended up finding?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the thing, Greg, is that, you know, due to my books being out there and, you know, some TV shows that I've done on the topic, I continue to get reports from, you know, people, you know, seemingly credible eyewitnesses that have had these remarkable encounters with different flying cryptids. So, you know, I find that very inspirational, you know, the fact that I think that we're really just scratching the surface here in terms of the amount of material that's out there that's been documented. And I was very fortunate to come across quite a wealth of material. But, you know, it really makes me wonder how many people out there have had these experiences that are, you know, for whatever reason, you know, probably ridicule and so forth, have been reluctant to come forward and share their experiences. So it's definitely a fascinating mystery.
Yeah, man. And I do want to go into a few of these stories. But before we do, the term flying humanoid is pretty wide and covers a diverse number of weird descriptions. But can you help the people get kind of a mental picture of what some of these creatures have looked like?
Well, you know, that's one of the really frustrating things, Greg, is that the descriptions of these so-called flying humanoids, you know, they seem to, whatever these things are, they seem to take a variety of different forms. Now, apart from the Mothman, of course, which is the most iconic figure within the phenomenon, the reports of the Mothman seem to be fairly consistent from a number of different eyewitnesses, but as you go across the globe, and it doesn't, in fact, appear to be a global phenomenon with sightings all over the world, the characteristics of these beings, apparitions, entities, whatever they are very, very different. Now, flying humanoid, of course, a very broad-based term. So you're talking about something that is, you know, for the most part, a humanoid type of form, you know, much like us.
Yeah.
Head, body, shoulders, arms, legs, but then in many cases, you know, the additional wings, you know, sometimes more animal-like characteristics, something halfway, you know, kind of a hybrid human-beast, you know, bat-man-type creatures, bird-man-type creatures, things like the Jersey Devil, essentially gargoyle types of creatures. And then in Mexico, you have these videos and alleged sightings of what they call unidentified flying humanoids, which are essentially just man-shaped figures without any types of wings or flying apparatus that are just kind of floating through the stratosphere. So quite a bit of diversity there in terms of descriptions.
Yeah, man, there was definitely a couple of weeks back in the day where I got really sucked into a ton of YouTube videos about dudes just floating in the sky in Mexico, and it's really trippy and really weird, and I don't know Spanish, so I'm listening to them talk about it, and I'm just like, it adds another layer of mystique to it, because I don't understand the language. I'm looking at the sky floating in the sky, and I'm like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, you would certainly expect to see, and you know, there have been theories put out there, and you know, perhaps in some cases these could be misidentifications of, some people have suggested maybe man-shaped balloons kind of being launched into the air, or some type of top secret government experiment where they're using some type of flying apparatus that maybe is not visible with the human eye. So, but they do seem to be quite prevalent, particularly over the past decades. So no one really knows exactly what's going on here.
Yeah, it's a weird one. But you've got stories in this book that go all the way back to the 1800s. But I mean, really, we have depictions of humans with wings going all the way back to Sumeria, the oldest known civilization with the earliest writings, along with things like Icarus and descriptions of even angels. I mean, the concept doesn't seem to be as foreign to humanity's history as it is in modern days, right?
Yeah, that's true. There, you know, in antiquity, we can find reference to winged humanoid types of beings, and as you suggested, I mean, these go back to the ancient Sumerian mythology. Different civilizations around the world had similar mythologies. The ancient Assyrians, the ancient Egyptians, the Aztecs and Maya. So Asia, Africa, like I said, it's a global phenomenon, and what's really, you know, to me, one of the really compelling aspects of the case is the fact that you have this lore, this mythology around the world of these types of beings. And they're often likened to, you know, essentially demigods, you know, so some type of higher beings.
It's a weird one. And like, you know, let's look at some of these early ones. I mean, the Wright brothers built their first working airplane in, I think it's 1903, if I'm not mistaken. So before that, people shouldn't be seeing anything other than birds in the sky, yet we have these stories. Can you tell us about a couple of those early sightings you have in the book from, like, the late 1800s, maybe the one of the ones you find most intriguing?
Well, one that's really very well known within the field, in the early part of the 1900s, actually right around the year 1900, a so-called Batman, and we're not talking about the Caped Crusader here, we're essentially what people described as a human-like form but with bat-like wings and kind of a hideous-looking face, was seen flying over Coney Island, New York, by, you know, allegedly hundreds of spectators kind of just flying through the air in what they described as a frog-like swimming motion. The same being was apparently seen a year earlier flying over Brooklyn by another gentleman. And so, you know, this is based on articles that were published in the New York Times over a century ago. In the 1800s, there were things like Spring-Heeled Jack, not a traditional flying humanoid in the sense that he wasn't really flying, but he, as his name would indicate, he was said to bound effortlessly through the air, impervious to gravity. And this strange being was cited by many people in the suburbs in and around London, England, back in the late 1830s and throughout the 19th century. There's also a case I talk about in the book, The Valkyrie of Voltaña, and you know, this is a small town in northern Spain where this, what was described as a woman with white flowing robes was seen kind of soaring through the air against the wind by a number of people. And some people even reported that they could hear this angelic singing voice or sound as she flew overhead. Those are just a few of the cases that have at least been documented and received a lot of notoriety.
Very weird, very diverse. And I really like the Spring-Heeled Jack one. It just sounded like some crazy scientist who made some weird invention. And, you know, a lot of those early stories, there's a couple of them in the book that seem to involve people with weird suits and mechanical-like wings, which makes me wonder if people weren't experimenting with flying in secret way back earlier than before we know.
Well, we certainly can't rule that out. And, you know, in the book I discuss, you know, Leonardo da Vinci, who, you know, of course, was a fabulous inventor and, yeah, you know, as well as being an artist, kind of a visionary. And he spent a great deal of his time apparently trying to construct artificial wings that could be strapped to his body so that he could fly through the air. And, you know, no one really knows if he was ever successful or not. We assume he was not Right. We're talking about the 1600s there. So, I mean, the concept, the notion that humans have been trying to devise artificial wings or flying contraptions goes back centuries. So who knows? Maybe some of these people were successful.
Yeah, man. And I like that you brought up Da Vinci, because I've heard this mystery before, and it you allude to it in the book. You kind of touch on it. But he has that painting, aerial view of a landscape, and the painting is so accurate. It looks like something off Google Maps, and it makes you wonder if he ever might have gotten airborne and not really told anyone about it.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is a pretty remarkable aerial view painting for someone that allegedly was never airborne. So it's definitely a great and enduring mystery throughout history.
All right, man. So to dive into some of these encounters, one of my favorite ones in the book was probably this one had by Leonardo Sammeningo. He was a Mexican police officer. Mm-hmm. And can you tell us about what happened with that one?
Yeah, definitely one of the strangest cases on record, and also, you know, a great topic of discussion. Many people do ask me about this case. And I had the great privilege of being able to interview this gentleman when I did an episode of a TV show called Monster Quest back in 2009. But yes, his name is Leonardo Sammeningo. He is a police officer in a community called Guadalupe, Mexico, which is kind of on the fringes of Monterrey. And back in 2004, he claimed that he was, you know, on patrol late one evening in a neighborhood, and he saw this shape kind of descending from the sky out of a, you know, apparently out of a tree. And at first he thought it was just like a big garbage bag that was kind of floating around in the air. But as he stopped his car and his eyes adjusted, he was shining his headlights on this thing, he could see that it was what he described as a hideous woman, kind of a hag-like witch with dark brown skin, large black lidless eyes, sharp claws, and she was kind of leering at him ominously. She was floating in the air. She wasn't actually standing on the ground. She was floating several feet above the ground. And he said that she was wearing this black kind of hooded cloak, and pretty creepy. And he was obviously freaked out, as we would probably all be,
yeah.
And began to back his police car out of there while calling for backup. Well, he was kind of looking behind him as he was backing up. When he turned back around and faced forward, this apparition had shot through the air at his patrol car at an unbelievable speed and landed on the hood of his car and was actually clawing at him through his windshield. And this was more than poor Leonardo could take. He blacked out and went into shock, and was discovered a few minutes later by other responding officers and some EMS workers. Now, Leonardo was taken to the hospital and was evaluated for, you know, psychological problems. He was tested for substances, and he got a clean bill of health. This made big news in Mexico. It was kind of headline news on the local news channels and newspapers. No one really knows exactly what he saw. Now, after his sighting, apparently other people did come forward and claim that they had also seen what was described as a bruja, or a witch. Spanish word for witch is bruja. So when we interviewed Leonardo back in 2009, this is 5 years later, he's still a police officer working there in Guadalupe. This gentleman actually broke down and wept throughout the interview. He said that he still has nightmares about this experience, and it's really affected his life in a pretty profound way. So, you know, this is a tough hombre. That was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, man, it seems like an extra strange encounter, because they don't usually seem to be that intense. They like coming right up on the hood and trying to physically attack it. It doesn't seem like that happens all that much, right? That's kind of rare.
Well, not necessarily. Now,
no.
There have been many cases. For example, when we go, you know, going back again to the Mothman, which was reported numerous times in the years 1966 and 1967 in and around a little town called Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Mothman was said to have chased people's cars at speeds approaching 100 miles an hour, essentially trying to frighten or terrify them. The same behavior was described by another gentleman in Mexico back in 2009 who claimed that his car was chased by this horrible flying human-like creature. There were two gentlemen in Wisconsin back in 2006 who claimed that their car was dive-bombed by this creature that was kind of a bat, man-bat type of creature that was very hideous-looking. So there does seem to be, you know, many cases where these creatures, beings, are seemingly aggressive towards humans. Now, no one's ever claimed that they've actually been physically accosted or assaulted by one of these things. But they do seem to want to chase, terrify, and attack human beings at every given opportunity.
I'm curious because some of these things, it's hard for me to visualize because they seem to be almost more paranormal than flesh and blood. Do you think they're split or do they lean one way or the other?
Well, you know, as a traditional cryptozoologist, I have a really tough time accepting these things as flesh and blood, and that's why I keep referring to them as apparitions and entities. No one really, of course, knows what they are. It's pure speculation at this point, but there is nothing in the natural world, in our fossil history, that would indicate that humanoids or human-like forms have ever developed wings or that anything looks remotely like a flying humanoid. And, you know, their behavior, as I suggested, is, you know, quite unnatural as well. So, you know, I really do, my personal feeling is that these things are somehow supernatural in nature, not wholly flesh and blood creatures, at least in the way that we understand it, although they do appear to have physical presence or characteristics somehow manifesting into a physical form. But, you know, there are a number of different words that have been tossed around. You know, some people refer to them as interdimensional or extraterrestrial, supernatural. So, I mean, you know, you kind of take your pick there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I definitely do not think that they are, you know, flesh and blood creatures in the way that we perceive it.
Do you put much stock in the theory that some of these sightings of these winged creatures are some type of metaphysical bad omen or a warning of impending doom? I know that's popular.
Yeah, that's another kind of prevalent theme. You know, and this goes back to the ancient Assyrians. You know, they worshipped a winged demon known as Pazuzu. And Pazuzu, of course, might be familiar to those listeners out there who are fans of the Exorcist movies, because Pazuzu is the demon that's kind of the antagonist in the Exorcist trilogy. But Pazuzu was viewed by the ancient Assyrians as a bad omen, a harbinger of cataclysmic events, famines, floods, droughts, and so forth. You know, there are other legends around the world. The Scree of Scotland is a flying witch-like creature that has been associated with, you know, war and different other disasters. You know, most of the flying humanoid legends around the world kind of characterize these beings as bad omens. Now, again, talking about the iconic Mothman, there was a tragic bridge collapse that occurred in December of 1967 in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, where 46 people lost their life when this bridge collapsed and these cars plunged into the icy cold Ohio River. And this was right around the time that Mothman was being sighted or reported in and around Point Pleasant. So to this day, many of the people that I've interviewed from Point Pleasant view the appearance of the Mothman as a omen that this horrible bridge collapse was going to happen. So
trippy stuff, man. And you mentioned the fossil record, and I've heard you also talk about, I think a previous book of yours is Big Bird, where you talk about sightings of more bird-like cryptids. But in terms of the fossil record, there is something there for thunderbirds, which is kind of interesting because I've always thought that was a fascinating concept of these massive, massive kind of mystical, weird, strange birds found. But tell us about pteratorns. I'd never heard this before.
Yeah, the pteratorns were massive birds that lived during the Ice Age up until about, you know, 10 to 12,000 years ago. We found fossils that are 10,000 years old in the La Brea Tar Pits of California and elsewhere in the western United States and also in South America. And these pteratorns, which probably resembled condors and also vultures, they were seemingly related, had wingspans anywhere from 12 to 17, 18 in North America, feet across. And in South America, there was a specimen known as Argentavis that had a wingspan of about 24 feet across. So essentially airplane-sized birds from the raptor family. So they did exist, we know from the fossil history, at one time. And these descriptions very much match with modern descriptions of so-called thunderbirds. Thunderbird is a name that's sort of borrowed from Native American mythology. Many different indigenous tribes around North America speak of these so-called thunderbirds, which were so big that they could block out the sun when they flew overhead, and they are often associated with storm fronts, hence the name thunderbirds. So, you know, very compelling evidence there that if these thunderbirds do exist, and I've actually documented and collected many, many modern sightings of these thunderbirds all over North America, that they are perhaps related to the pterotaurs. You know, it wouldn't be the first time, Greg, that a fossil form has essentially sprung to life, you know, that has been discovered in some remote corner of the planet. Something that we assumed has been extinct for thousands or millions of years has been discovered alive and well. So that is a possibility.
Yeah. And in that same vein, I know there's a lot of sightings also in that Big Bird book about modern day pterodactyls in Texas, of all places. What's up with that? I mean, are there any good stories there?
Oh, yeah. You know, and when I mentioned the thunderbirds, I should have also explained that I do receive pretty much an equal number of reports of the traditional thunderbirds, which again are described as giant feathered black birds, very similar with a hooked beak, very similar to an eagle or a vulture.
Mm-hmm.
But an equal number of people have reported to me that they've seen something quite different, that they also refer to as thunderbirds, even though they're not birds at all. They seem to be related to the, as you mentioned, the pterosaurs, which were enormous, in many cases, enormous flying reptiles that were contemporary with the dinosaurs, and we're very familiar with them from fossils that have been found. But these were, you know, basically giant flying reptiles with bat-like wings, presumably leathery skin. You know, of course, the pterodactyls, which are very familiar to most listeners because of their appearance in movies like Jurassic Park and so forth, had a large head-like or large crest on the back of their head. But many people have reported to me that they've seen these living pterosaurs throughout North America and elsewhere. Now, that's really even more of a mystery because, as I mentioned, these things have presumably been extinct for 65 million years, and there's no trace of them in the fossil history within the past 65 million years. So a little bit more hard to believe that something like that could survive that span of time, as opposed to the pterotaurs, which lived only 10,000 years ago, which is really only a blink of an eye in geologic time. But mm-hmm. I do get equal numbers of both kinds of flying cryptids.
It would be so awesome to find out that pterodactyls had survived in some remote island or some kind of crazy place. But if for some weird reason they were still around in small numbers, I mean, that would it could explain some of those weird Batman-like sightings of the 1800s, because they might not have been as familiar, and they do have kind of long legs, if I remember correctly, but weird.
Yeah, they have some characteristics that could be described as similar to a bat, perhaps, which would again be likened to a primate or a human. But moreover, I mean, I think if pterodactyls had survived, it would explain the legends of flying dragons and dragon-like creatures all over the world for centuries, because they look pretty much as close to our interpretation of a dragon, say from the Hobbit movies, than anything else that we can really think of. Now,
true.
You mentioned remote corners of the planet. There have been accounts of these living pterodactyls from places like Africa, Central Africa, and also from Papua New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
Which are, you know, very, very remote and unexplored wilderness areas. So, I mean, I guess that is perhaps a little bit easier to believe than, say, the reports that I've collected from places like Georgia and Oregon. But, you know, as a cryptozoologist, I try to remain as open-minded as possible. And, you know, certainly, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there have been things that have been discovered out there that scientists were reluctant to accept until we found them in the flesh. So it is a possibility.
Absolutely, man. And speaking of Texas, with some of these pterodactyl sightings, this is also where, of course, the Houston Batman is from, which is, I believe, your hometown, right? And I really like that one. There seems to be a lot of witnesses.
Yeah, the Houston Batman is another great story, and it was first referenced by in Freudian literature by, of course, the great John Keel, who wrote the Mothman Prophecies book and is kind of the pioneer in flying humanoid research. I've kind of tried to follow in his footsteps. But I lived in Houston, Texas for about 20 years. I was familiar with the story, of course, because I've been reading Keel's book since I was a young boy. But the Houston Batman was allegedly encountered by three people back on June 18th of 1953, and this was in an old neighborhood in northern Houston known as the Heights. And according to these people, they were out sitting on their porch one night. It was very hot. It was, you know, obviously during the summer. Anyone that's been to Houston during June knows how hot it can get, even at night. Very humid, and they apparently didn't have an air conditioner. So they're sitting out on their patio, and suddenly they saw this shadowy figure moving through the air. And at first they thought it might be just a large moth that was being silhouetted by the streetlights. And, you know, as their eyes adjusted to the light, they saw this thing kind of land on the branch of a large pecan tree. And as they watched it, they could make out the figure of what they described as a large man standing about 6.5 feet tall, with bat-like wings attached to his back and shoulders. And what's really weird is that they described him as wearing a paratrooper type of uniform with a helmet, knee-length boots, and a tight-fitting black suit. And he also appeared to be giving off this strange yellowish-gray glow. And for several minutes, he kind of rocked back and forth on the branch of this large pecan tree, and then the light began to fade out, and he literally vanished from their sight. And a few minutes later, they also witnessed what they described as a torpedo-shaped object shooting up into the air. So one particular witness, this woman named Hilda Walker, was so freaked out that she went to the local police and filed a report the next morning. And subsequently, the Houston Batman was featured in a newspaper article in the Houston Chronicle newspaper. So that's how we learned about the Houston Batman. There have not been any subsequent reports that I'm aware of, but a pretty chilling tale.
Yeah, I mean, what possible explanation could that be? The outfit makes me almost think it's like a secret military experiment, if nothing else.
Well, yeah, you would think so, something along those lines. Or, you know, this is 1953, we mustn't forget, was kind of in the middle of the so-called flying saucer wave, you know, where, you know, beginning in 1947, when the name flying saucer was coined right after World War II, and, you know, following the testing of the atomic bomb and the detonation of atomic bombs in Japan, we had these reports of these so-called flying saucers that were, you know, being sighted all over the United States and elsewhere. And understandably, people associate the Houston Batman with kind of a UFO or extraterrestrial origin. But you're right, it could also be some type of covert government experiment or, you know, black ops type situation.
Well, on the subject of UFOs, you got a whole chapter on these types of sightings along with UFOs. Is there like a rich history of that? Seeing people alongside crafts, like seeing people that are also coming off the ground alongside these crafts?
Well, I wanted to broaden the scope of the book. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly the people have written at length about Mothman, and there are some other types of flying humanoids out there that are lesser known. But I found throughout the course of my research that there do seem to be many cases of humanoid types of beings that are seen in conjunction with UFOs, and obviously they are, you know, impervious to gravity. They seem to be either floating through the air, flying through the air to the craft, and so forth. And, you know, with regard to the Mothman, at the time that Mothman was being sighted around Point Pleasant, West Virginia, there were also many reports of flying saucers and lights in the sky. I say flying saucers, I should say UFOs, and lights in the sky. Many of these were seen by John Keel when he was in Point Pleasant investigating, other local residents. So there does seem to be some type of association with at least some of these flying humanoid beings and the UFO phenomenon. What that connection or that link is, I can't say for sure, but I definitely wanted to draw attention to that in the book because it seems to be a factor.
Absolutely, man. And I also love examining myths and legends or, you know, stories of angels, which are flying people. It's interesting because we assume, or conventional history tells us, that anything that's the myth is just based in complete fantasy. But it makes me wonder sometimes where some of these ideas come from. And an example you have in the book is the Japanese have a legend that I hadn't heard before about something called the Tengu, which is kind of in this wheelhouse, correct?
Yeah, the Tengu, very prevalent in Japanese folklore going back to medieval times, have been written about extensively in different legends and poems and so forth. The Tengu are essentially birdmen, and in the sense that they are, you know, human-like in form, except that they have these large feathered wings, and in many cases they have either a beak or a long nose that looks like a beak, which is kind of interesting. The Tengu are described as mischievous forest spirits, not necessarily dangerous to humans. Oftentimes they're characterized as being very playful, but in many cases they are perhaps vengeful and somewhat malevolent towards human beings. So the Tengu fit it kind of into a category, and I tried to classify these different flying humanoids as best I could, Greg, even though it was quite a challenge because of the, you know, the broad range and scope of descriptions. But the Tengu, you know, I put into a chapter about what are called birdmen, and the birdmen, just as the name would indicate, are essentially man-like figures that have been described as having large feathered wings. And then another category I described are the Batmen, which we've talked about a few of those already, that, you know, are essentially man-like but have the traditional leathery kind of bat-like wings. So, you know, kind of a tall order in terms of trying to make any sense of this particular enigma. But there do seem to be at least a few major groups of flying humanoids that have been documented.
Yeah, and the reason I brought up the Tengu is because I love when sightings can somewhat coordinate with a legend, because it just adds a layer to that legend. And there's sort of an example of this in your book where I think it was a U.S. soldier was stationed in Japan, yep, and he saw something that kind of fit the description, right?
Yeah, back in 1953, a U.S. soldier named Earl Morrison, who was stationed in Kyoto, Japan, he was standing guard duty one night, and he claimed that this thing came out of the air and terror, you know, startled him, and he actually took a shot at it. At first he thought it was a large bird approaching him, but he said as this thing got very close to him, he could definitely make out that it was very human-like in appearance, although it did have large feathered wings. And he reported to his commanding officer that he actually fired at this thing, and it kind of vanished. And he later found out that another soldier that was also standing sentry in the same location had encountered the same thing, I think, a year before. So, you know, his description is actually kind of dead on as far as the Japanese Tengu goes. So, you know, essentially you have this kind of, as you suggest, you know, you have this folklore, this mythological creature, and then, you know, suddenly you have a sighting that puts it into a modern context.
Yeah.
Quite remarkable.
And I wonder if there's some ability of the human mind that we don't fully understand to manifest things that we come up with in our imagination. Because you see people who are magic practitioners, they talk about conjuring and summoning and evocation. And I wonder if there's not some mechanism that's left unexplored that brings these beings into existence somehow. And it's weird, but it seems like something like that could be a possible explanation.
Well, yeah, certainly if you broaden your scope of possibilities, and I think this is something that I mentioned in the concluding chapter of the book, it has been suggested that humans may have the ability, because we certainly know and understand that our minds are far more powerful than we can imagine. And if you buy into, you know, the ability of humans to have, you know, different telepathic abilities and so forth, who's to say that we do not have the ability to manifest these, you know, kind of physical constructs from the deep recesses of our mind? And, you know, a lot of this goes back to, for example, the Swiss psychologist Carl Jung and, you know, his theory about a global consciousness and the fact that all human beings throughout history, that we've been connected kind of on a subconscious level. And that's why you have these prevalent themes that have recurred throughout history. And a lot of them do relate to our spiritual beliefs and superstitions and folklores and so forth. So that is one possibility, I think, is that we are actually able to, for whatever reason, essentially take these, you know, darkest fears from our unconscious minds and project them almost like a hologram onto the fabric of our reality.
Yeah, it's trippy stuff, but you got to find an answer somewhere. And I think that, as slippery as it is to define, I think it might be something in that vein. But it would also be interesting for someone to go and look at all these sightings and see if, outside of just Mothman, if there are other disasters that coordinate with them. You know, maybe something happened in Japan around the time of the Tengu sightings that we just talked about, or some kind of weird, like maybe there were Mothman type visions around Fukushima or 9/11 or something like that, you know?
Yeah, well, there are kind of ambiguous statements to that effect. There were flying humanoids sighted, for example, right before 9/11, flying over Manhattan, you know, right over Japan before the Fukushima accident, right over Chernobyl before the nuclear accident there. I haven't been able to verify any of those, although I've heard these rumors floating around.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, you've got to wonder if this somehow, again, goes back to, you know, the concept of prophecy, you know, and whether these things are somehow, you know, they're omengers, that we somehow summon them, maybe collectively to warn us, you know, about things, you know, impending disasters and other tragic events.
Yeah. Again, it's so hard to even talk about without sounding so silly, but I mean, there's a lot of sightings out there. People are seeing something. And another thing I loved about your book is you have a whole section on modern sightings specifically, which is missing from a lot of cryptid books, because it's great to hear about things people saw in the 1800s or even the 1960s, but I'm kind of more interested in what people are seeing now. You know, I want to know that I have a chance of seeing whatever it is that I'm reading about. And it's kind of been a while since the book came out. Are there any hotbeds of flying humanoids in the States right now, like if I wanted to go out hoping for a sighting?
Well, there are, you know, one of the great benefits of being able to put a book like this out and do interviews like I'm doing with you and appearing on different television shows that deal with the subject is that it does create an environment where people are willing to perhaps come forward and talk about experiences that they've always been reluctant to share. You know, there's an obvious element of ridicule that's associated with these types of claims. But, you know, I do continue to get reports and receive reports on a regular basis. And I always make an attempt to interview these people and to, you know, certainly there are cases where perhaps people are either delusional or hallucinating or misidentifying what they're seeing, misinterpreting. But I continue to get reports from people, and some of them seem to be quite credible. I mean, these are very sincere people that believe that they've seen these creatures. They obviously have no explanation for what it is they're seeing. So, you know, it's an ongoing phenomenon, you know, and as I said at the outset, I really think that the number of accounts that I write about in the book that are documented are probably only scratching the surface. There must be, in my mind, you know, thousands of encounters that have never come to light because people just simply have not wanted to talk about it and just, you know, don't know where to go with this information.
Absolutely. I'd venture to guess the same thing. And you mentioned Mexico a little bit earlier, and Mexico does seem to have
just a ton of UFO sightings and flying humanoid sightings recently. I mean, would you say we get more video evidence from Mexico than any other place? It seems that way to me.
Well, yeah, and I think that's a fair statement. I've spent a lot of time researching down there for the, you know, flying, not only flying humanoids, but also other mysterious creatures. Mexico is a nation that is really steeped in mystery, and, you know, you could make a case that it probably stems back to the great civilizations that developed there, you know, the Maya, Aztec, Zapotec, Olmec, you know, all of these ancient civilizations that, you know, many people have sort of linked or connected to the UFO phenomenon, ancient aliens and so forth, if you believe in that type of thing. But moreover, people in Mexico the culture there seems to be very accepting of mystery and the unexplained. And that's one thing I've found when I've gone down there is, you know, they're very aware and very keen that there are things going on around them that, you know, perhaps here in the United States, we live in a little bit more of a kind of a skeptical culture, and we try to find a comfort in the explainable possibilities, which, you know, I understand that. We like to consider ourselves to be a very advanced culture up here. In Mexico, though, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, when a police officer claims he encounters a flying witch, it's not a B-side story that's, you know, kind of smirked at it. It's actually headline news, you know? So, you know, and with regard to the UFO phenomenon, you have a number of really dedicated UFO researchers down in Mexico, sky watchers that spend a considerable amount of time scanning the air and looking for these things. So, you know, I think the fact that they're very proactive and also very open-minded, I think that creates a lot of opportunities for these incidents to come to light.
Well, another interesting thread on that line is that some researchers kind of conclude that belief and acceptance and willingness to see these things is almost a requirement for a prerequisite for their appearance. Because in the conclusion section of the book, you kind of talk about the possibility that intuition is involved, because a lot of the sightings of Mothman, or a lot of the witnesses of Mothman, seem to be younger women, and people talk about children being more open to it, and especially women. So that kind of maybe allows these things to come into their reality. And if people have a culture of that in Mexico, that would kind of be an explanation for why they're seeing more things.
Yeah, that's a great point, Greg. You know, as we get older, for example, we tend to develop filters or boundaries. You know, we define our own reality, and you know, therefore we may not be as perceptive to things that are going on around us, because they simply do not fit neatly into the paradigm of what we want to, you know, how we want to live our lives. You know, when we're very young, we have this, you know, great willingness to open ourselves up and to really view the world with these, you know, with a very young and fresh perspective. And, you know, therefore there are a number of accounts of young people, for example, seeing not only these flying humanoids, and I document many cases of that in the book, but all, you know, also other types of inexplicable phenomenon within the realms of cryptozoology, the, you know, supernatural, UFOs and so forth. So, that's a great point. You know, I think their willingness in Mexico perhaps to embrace the possibility that some of these things do exist perhaps allow them to, you know, open up their filters and see these things, whereas here in North America, you know, we've kind of set our boundaries and therefore maybe not as apt to encounter or experience them.
Yeah, man, I agree. And not to be too conspiratorial, but I've had researchers come on the show in a broader sense talking about life in general that say that the elite are so adamant about defining that for children, you know, magic isn't real, monsters aren't real, you can't affect your reality. They're so adamant about throwing those things into the minds of younger people, because you do have the power to shape your reality. But if they define it for you and they put you in a smaller box and you feel more powerless, you're just going to go to your 9-to-5 job for a few decades and then call it a day. So maybe there is some mechanism there that applies to all areas of life, including weird cryptid sightings. But
yeah,
on this, oh, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm sorry. And, you know, just on that point, if I can make like a brief social commentary about that,
yeah.
You know, it seems that in the day and age we live in now with the amazing technology and stuff that's available, as I look around, I see everyone around me kind of staring into their mobile devices. You know, they've got a little virtual computer screen in front of their face. So in that sense, I think that we probably are going to be losing touch even more with our environment, our natural environment, and things that are going on around us. You know, as I travel around the world, and I've had the great fortune to travel to, you know, 26 different countries on every continent except for Antarctica, countries that are, for the lack of a better word, third world countries and countries where they are not able to acquire this technology, you see people that essentially are just sitting outside, sitting on their front porch, sitting on a park bench, and just observing the world around them. And that's what people do in some of these other countries. And so I think that's very advantageous for them in terms of being able to really experience life and perhaps experience some of these great mysteries that are occurring around them. So
yeah.
I think here in the U.S., I think we're going to, as time goes on, we become more and more dependent on these mobile devices and so forth, that we're going to be missing out on quite a bit.
I agree. I mean, on one hand, you can't see what's going on in the sky if you're looking down at your phone. But on the other hand, everybody's got a recording device with them.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's true.
On the to talk about Mexico one more time, the Chupacabra obviously is a legendary cryptid in that area, and the Southern California area. There's been a few sightings. But I just interviewed Robert Morningstar, who's more of a UFO guy, more of a secret space program guy. But he has a theory that the Chupacabra are actually the hunting dogs of the Greys, which is a really, really well-defined and far-out explanation. But do you have any thoughts on what the Chupacabra could be?
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to second-guess his expertise, because he's very, very knowledgeable in a number of areas.
True.
But you know, I also have to say that there's almost an anthropomorphic line of thinking that humans tend to do. And that, of course, anthropomorphic means that we tend to shift our experience as human beings onto, you know, other theoretical, shall we say, life forms. So, you know, the notion that a race of you know, of intelligent beings from another place, wherever you want to say they're from, another dimension, planet, galaxy, whatever, that they would follow a similar pattern as us in terms of having hunting dogs. I'm not sure that that's, you know, I just feel that that's slightly overthinking the situation, you know. My own personal view is that we can't even begin to imagine or speculate about what other intelligences, what they do, how they behave, what technologies they possess, and so forth. So I prefer to be a little bit more conservative in terms of that. But it should be pointed out that the so-called Chupacabra, which is kind of a broad term now that's associated with a lot of different things that are going on in the Americas, the original Puerto Rican Chupacabra, there were many, many sightings of UFOs that were reported in the areas where these livestock killings were taking place. So in that sense, there at least appears to be an extraterrestrial connection between some of the Chupacabra cases. So I don't think we can rule that out, but I think referring to them as hunting dogs strikes me as perhaps a little bit anthropomorphic.
Yeah. I agree with you. I loved hearing about that because, I mean, there's got to be some kind of explanation, but I was like, wow, it's one I haven't heard. And, you know, being in this field, when you hear one you haven't heard, lights go off, you know, it's exciting.
No, you know, I appreciate you sharing that. And again, I don't want to question his expertise because he certainly seems very knowledgeable, but, you know, would beings that were able to travel from other dimensions or other galaxies, would they need hunting dogs? I mean,
good point. But, you know, this is sort of an unrelated thing. But before we call it in, I wanted to ask you about your travels, because you mentioned in the book that you've gotten to visit Peru and Machu Picchu and the Galapagos Islands when you were a kid. And those are areas that I'd like to visit more than probably any other on the planet. So how was it just in, you know, I'm sure you didn't see any cryptids, but was it great to get to see some of those places?
Oh, yeah. I had an unbelievable upbringing, and I think that kind of led me down the path to where I'm at now. So I feel very blessed in that regard. My mother was a travel agent, and she was very adventurous and wanted to take me to all these exotic locations around the world. So Machu Picchu, you know, and I'm not necessarily a spiritual person per se, but when you're in that environment up in these lofty, you know, the lofty Andes Mountains and these great ruins, and it does have a very sort of cosmic and spiritual aura. You know, and when you think about this incredible civilization, the Incas, and you know, the wonderful things that they were able to achieve so long ago, I mean, it really makes you wonder how they got this, the inspiration to, you know, not only to build these magnificent ruins, but also some of the other technologies. I mean, they were actually doing brain surgery, you know, things like that. So, I mean, it's pretty remarkable. You know, and as a naturalist, the Galapagos Islands, of course, was an unbelievable experience too. Not only because of what it means to, you know, or what it meant to Darwin and you know, the formulation of his theory of evolution. You know, but I will share one anecdotal thing. I've never seen a cryptid with my own eyes, but I have seen some pretty remarkable animals in the wild. And while in the Galapagos Islands, I was kind of wandering around as a young boy on this one island, and this giant elephant, male elephant seal, surfaced in this freshwater pool right next to me. And I mean, this thing was literally as big as a car, if not bigger. I think they get to be like almost 20 feet long. And it came out of the water right next to me and bellowed at me in this thunderous voice. And it was both terrifying and also quite exhilarating at the same time to have that type of encounter with something so remarkable. So,
nice.
And also on that same trip, we also camped along the Amazon. So that was pretty amazing as well.
Wow. Yeah, man. I would love to do that sometime. I hear a lot of people telling stories that it seems dangerous just to be there because the jungle is so full of dangerous insects and bugs and jaguars and all kinds of wild stuff. And so you are taking a little bit of a risk just being there because the unplanned for can happen. But yeah, it seems like, I mean, you know, we're here today, so obviously we've done it for thousands and thousands of years. But it sounds a little bit scary, a little bit outside of my comfort zone.
Well, Greg, you really haven't. I don't think you've really lived life to the fullest until you've put yourself out there. And I think life really is about taking risks and chances and sometimes living a little bit dangerously.
I hear you.
It's all about the opportunity. And there's also the financial aspect.
Yeah.
It's certainly not cheap to travel to some of these exotic locations. So but I would encourage anyone out there listening to really, any opportunity you have to travel and to explore the world. I mean, life is short, and there are so many wonderful places out there that to see and experience them firsthand is something that you would never regret.
Well said, man. As soon as I have a couple thousand to burn, Peru is probably the top of my list. But very cool, Ken. I loved having you here. Always down to hear about some weird stuff going on, and weird creatures and ones with wings are all that much more fascinating. Would you like to tell the people about anything else you got going on, or maybe your website before we go?
Well, you know, I have a couple of television appearances that are going to be occurring later this year. One of them pertains to the Mexican Chupacabra, who you mentioned earlier. I don't really have exact details as far as air dates or channels or anything. So, you know, hopefully people that are, they're interested in this subject matter will just kind of keep their eyes open. But, if they want to follow my research and, you know, updates as far as when these things are taking place, I do have a website. It's kengerhard.com, KENGERHARD. I also have a Facebook fan page, and, those are probably the best places to go if you want to, find out about what's going on in my world. And I would also encourage anyone out there that's interested in flying cryptids to check out my books. As you mentioned, Encounters with Flying Humanoids, available online at most major book retailers, also available at Barnes & Noble locations. And my first book, Big Bird, Modern Sightings of Flying Monsters, also available and a fascinating read.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks again, Ken. It has been a blast. You take care of yourself out there, all right?
You too, Greg. Great interview. I had a wonderful time, and hopefully we can do it again real soon.
Thanks, man. Of course. Take care. Have you been up late nights? It's okay. It's just been hard.
future boss.
He's not feeling well, but he's alright.
There's something I can do.
Thanks for offering, but I'll be fine.
Late nights
before I get to sleep.
I see it in your eyes.
It's just the sickness has been getting to me.
Well, what about your bell?
Can you help or can you make the time?
I'll do all I can do.
Just don't worry about me, I'll be fine. Everyone wants to feel safe. Said you're not all right.
You take care of you.
There's something bigger going on this time. Everyone wants to feel safe in the dark. Everyone wants to feel safe.
Good night, all my children, now you must lay down your heads. You wouldn't want the sun to catch you missing from your beds. I wish that we could stay here, I wish with all my heart. But to the earth we've been committed, and now we must depart. Good night.